on the continuum of things, would you classify yourself to be more of an introvert or more of an extrovert? I suppose we've all done some sort of self-classification at one time or another, or maybe you've even taken a test that purportedly will tell you which way you tilt, or at least as far as the test makers and interpreters are concerned. It's kind of an interesting thing, though, that of late there has been something of a popular redefinition of what those terms mean. We typically, I think popularly, think of someone who is an introvert as being shy, withdrawn even, or very reserved, and someone who is an extrovert as being very sociable, very outgoing. Actually, in terms of dictionary definition, for example, an introvert is said to be someone who turns inward, and an extrovert, someone who turns outward. Well, as we're kind of redefining that, or at least popularizing it in our society, the idea now is more of where one receives strength, or where one receives renewal. So a person who is an introvert, for example, tends to be more alone and to recharge, to renew. And the person who is an extrovert goes out and is with other people and gets the charge, gets the renewal of life and of stamina for the ongoing of life from other people. And yet we all know that it's impossible to be at one extreme or the other. Because if someone, for example, were totally an extrovert and couldn't turn inward for resources at all, then that person would be psychically bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt, would not have the ability ever to cope alone. And on the other extreme, someone who is constantly alone and dependent upon oneself could, I suppose we might say, self-destruct, for there would be no drawing of the resources of the broader community. Now, God is concerned about both, and God seeks that we have a balance within the context of who we are, that there be both a strength and a renewal on the inside, and so it is possible for a Christian so strengthened by God to be able to stand sometimes against formidable evil, and at the same time also to receive strength and renewal from community, that we are not isolated islands that are unto ourselves. Now, as I think about this, it seems to me that often as we talk within the context of the church and we read the Bible and study it and lessons are taught and sermons are preached, that the major part of the emphasis is upon the internal, and maybe rightly so, how we relate to God, what kind of people we are on the inside. We sometimes read or hear those who say, who are we when we're alone, or when we are by ourselves in our own thoughts, late at night. That's the real person that we are. That type of thing, and how we are to relate to God and how he gives to us strength, especially through the empowering of his Spirit who lives within every Christian. And that's all wonderfully good and important and necessary. But it's only part of the picture of what God gives to us as Christians. The broader picture includes also, as often repeated within the Bible, that we are part of community. That we are not isolated, that we cannot, in fact, we should not stand alone. That it is one of the wonderful joys of the Christian life and of a common relationship with Jesus Christ that we're together, that we have one another. One of the early church fathers says that the Bible knows nothing of the independent or isolated Christian. That even when we're apart, physically, even when a person, because of special circumstances, is isolated in some distant part of the world or in some other special place, we're still belongers. We still belong to the community of Christians alive today and the community of Christians that has been around for 2,000 years. And it's great. It's a wonderful thing. And it is basic to what St. John wrote when he picked up his pen again after having written his first and longer letter that we call 1 John, and the next one is, of course, called 2 John. Only 300 words in the original Greek text in which he wrote, just about the right size for a piece of papyrus. So on the parchment that was receiving his ink, all the words that we have in the little book, one of the smallest of the entire Bible, called 2 John, could fit longhand in Greek on one page of paper. He was writing at a time when he was an old man, probably almost the close of the first century, perhaps around AD 95. He was writing as he wrote his first letter from the city of Ephesus. And he wrote it in a form that's kind of different from the way we would typically write our letters today. For if you were writing a letter to a friend, you would start out that letter saying, dear, and the person's name, dear friend, and then get right into why you are writing, and then at the end, put sincerely or cordially or lovingly and sign your name at the end of it. However, in the first century and in the Greek culture, they wrote letters differently, more, I think you would say, like a business memorandum that we would have today. One that starts out, first of all, saying who it's from, and next saying who it's to, and next finally getting into the subject matter of the memo that is being read. Now, with all of that sort of as background, look with me to 2 John. It has no chapters, only verses. Verses 1 through 3. It starts out saying that it is from the elder. He doesn't even list his name. But everyone knew that it was John. In fact, the records of ancient history are multiple in their insistence that John was that author. This old man, describing himself chronologically as an elder, perhaps 90 years old or pushing toward 100. And yet it was more than that. For when the Greeks used the word elder, they used it not only to refer to someone's age, but also to refer to someone's position in relationship to others, particularly in community. So the town, like the city council, would have seated on it elders. There were the elders of the community, and there were the elders of the nation, and there were the elders of the church. They were often older in age, but not necessarily. They were the ones who were the political leaders or the spiritual leaders. They were the ones who gave direction to the community together. And it is just in that position that this old man writes. And he continues, saying that it is to, in his memorandum, the chosen lady and her children. Now, that's a strange address. Who is she? Some female friend of old John? Is he looking for marriage or remarriage? Is this perhaps a romantic love letter? Actually, there's some people who think that it is. Or at least he's addressing the letter perhaps to some Christian lady, a widow perhaps, who has children, maybe some at home, most of them grown up. Maybe some have said the church gathered in her home. We have indications that in the first and the second century there were churches, sometimes of 1,000 more, that gathered in some of the huge Roman houses that were the premier showpieces of the residences of the empire. Or perhaps was it someone else, something not quite so clear in identity. Let me give you a comparison. We often receive here at Wooddale what I would call cryptic, in the sense of code, cryptic letters from our missionaries, from individuals that come here on Sunday mornings and share on the witness stand, or will be here in the end of October for World Evangelism Week, and yet the letters are unsigned or unusually addressed. Typically, because those letters come from what we call limited access countries or peoples of the world. Most often, they are from nations where the majority of the people are Muslim or where the government is communist. And because of that, there are all kinds of restrictions on those people being there in terms of proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sometimes they are there with visas that have limitations on them, and they want to be careful that they are not especially known as missionaries, because that could jeopardize their right to stay within the country. So, for example, we have one Wooddaler who writes letters addressed to the Wooddale campus. And every day when one of those comes, I want to go over to the student union or sort of walk around out here in the parking lot and wonder what class to go to next. But that's instead of ever using the word church. And then that particular missionary or others will sometimes make multiple references to JC. So JC is in the first paragraph, and JC is in the second paragraph, and JC is all throughout the letter, and that, of course, refers to Jesus Christ. And then, maybe even more obvious to us, but not to others who may be the censors of such letters, are references to brothers and sisters. And someone who recently became a brother and sister, a brother or sister within the family. And then references to talking to him about particular issues and needs. And then the letters may be signed at the end without the name at all, the individual, simply signed, your brother or your friend. I pick up letters like that, and I have no difficulty at all knowing that the Wooddale campus is Wooddale Church, and I have no difficulty recognizing the initials of Jesus Christ, and that brothers and sisters are fellow Christians, and that the family is the family of God and the Church of Jesus Christ, and can figure out pretty quickly who that friend is and why the letter is written in that particular way. And then when I respond in similar vein. For example, I don't use the address here of Wooddale Church, but use my home address instead, and I'm careful not to use church stationery, and all of the things. But again, it's understood. It's understood by the recipient because we share a common background and a common commitment and a common understanding of what the letter is all about. By the end of the first century, there was persecution that was beginning to happen across the Roman Empire, a great deal unlike what has been experienced in communist lands and Muslim countries and other places here in the 20th century. Although I will tell you, as I think I have sometimes mentioned before, it has never before in history been to the magnitude of the 20th century. There are far more people who have died for the cause of Jesus Christ in this century than in any other century, and it is possible, some say, that there may be more martyrs for Jesus Christ by the close of this century, in this century, than all of the previous 19 combined. For while we have great freedom in terms of our communication, many people in the world do not have that kind of freedom. It is they who I think would particularly understand why John, in an empire that was heathen and opposed to Christian truths and doctrines, would start out a letter without his name, saying the elder, and addressing it to the chosen lady and her children, referring probably not to some particular lady nor to any literal children, but in all probability referring to a church, a local assembly of believers, and to the members of that particular fellowship. Something initially clearly understood, as it was written by a man who understood himself the high price of persecution and being identified as a Christian. For he suffered. He was exiled by the Roman government to the island of Patmos, and it was there that he was a prisoner, unable to escape because of the surrounding sea. Remember that he was one of 12 disciples of Jesus, and by then he was the only one who was still alive. Judas, years earlier, after he had betrayed Jesus, had taken his own life. And then of the others, all of them had died as martyrs themselves because they belonged to Jesus Christ, except for John. He was the only one who was left. And so that's why John begins his letter saying, the elder, and refers to the church and the members of the church as the chosen lady and her children. And everyone knew exactly what he meant. He writes on, saying, whom I love in the truth. That's because John loved the church. This man who had been with Jesus, this man who was the only one of the disciples left, this man who knew the church well, loved the church. And I've got to tell you that when I read that, I identify wholeheartedly because I too love the church. I love the Church of Jesus Christ. As expressed down through the centuries, I love the Church of Jesus Christ around the world today, and I love the Church of Jesus Christ as assembled here in this building that we call Wooddale Church, that we know by a local name that identifies us, but most of all that we are still the Church of Jesus Christ. And I, like John, understand that the church has sins and inconsistencies, has people who don't do what they are supposed to do, and people who do things that they ought not do, understand that there are problems and hypocrisies and petty jealousies and pride and everything else. But John knew that as well. And yet he loved the church. He loved her. And he spoke of her that way in a personification. And I think that the reason that John did is perhaps the reason that I and you also love the Church of Jesus Christ. For it is here that I can find something that is nowhere else for me to be found. It is here that I find fellow sinners, for that's what we all are, who can kneel by my side can kneel with me at the foot of the cross of Jesus Christ and can say, it's not because of anything that I have done or said, it's not because I'm a good person or very good at anything that I am here. It is simply because I, like you, am a recipient of the enormous forgiveness that God has provided through Jesus Christ. It is within the church that I find love and understanding and acceptance and kindness and hope and forgiveness. It is in the church and with her children that there are truths and traditions that are God-given, that are as old as eternity itself. For the church of Jesus Christ is about Jesus Christ. I would agree with John when he speaks of her as being chosen, because I believe that the church of Jesus Christ is chosen by God. I believe that we are a supernatural community, that we are beyond any possible human explanation. For in spite of our human sins and failures and stupidities, in spite of the persecution that has taken place against the church and all the attempts to eradicate her through the years, the church has supernaturally survived. There's nothing like it anywhere else. There's nothing that is comparable. More than any country to which we could pledge allegiance, or any company of which we could be an employee or an owner, or any club of which we are a member, the Church of Jesus Christ is God's special body. It's like a chosen lady and her children, whom I love in the truth. And in case you don't already know, I'm glad to be a Christian. And I consider one of the greatest of God's gifts to us as Christians to be the Church of Jesus Christ. I'm grateful for salvation, and I do not underestimate eternal life. But I'm also glad for you that we can be together, that we can have a solidarity and a oneness, that I as a Christian and you as a Christian do not need to stand alone before God, but that we can be together, blessed together, as we share community. Now listen as John writes, "The elder, to the chosen lady and her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, it's because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love." He starts out by giving the bedrock basics of Christian community. They are truth and love. So in order to understand how a community can be a Christian community and be the Church of Jesus Christ, we must have truth. That Christian community is always rooted in truth, and that what we believe is just as important as that we believe. That is something I wish I could grasp hold of the words to describe how amazing it is to me, this uniformity, this common ground that we have in the truth of Jesus Christ everywhere. So I, for one, have picked up documents that were written almost 2,000 years ago by Christians far away in a different culture, in a different language, and I find that the same truth is shared. I remember one time when I rode in the back of a pickup truck up a mountain in Honduras. It seemed like we would never get to the top. I was out of breath. It was a place that, to my knowledge, at least in recent times, Americans had never been. And got up there and found a little tiny church building that had been built. And it was necessary to communicate through a translator. And yet, the message that was given and the sense of what was communicated was the same truth. I remember one time when an African intellectual was over here at the Radisson South giving a speech, and I sat, I think, in the back row and listened as a man whose intelligence and education far exceeded mine, and yet heard him talk about the truth, the same truth, the truth of God, the Trinity, of Jesus Christ, of salvation in the Bible. Or I think of when some of us gathered almost literally in whispers and talked together with Chinese Christians who are not free to worship God as we are, and listened as we had as the common ground the truth of Christianity, the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I've sat the multiplied hours in seminary classrooms, and it's the same truth. It's the same common truth of Jesus Christ and the Bible. So John wasn't alone. I'm not alone. They're not alone. We're together. Not I only, but also all who know the truth. It is the truth of Jesus Christ that transcends the otherwise differences that we have. So there are some who are younger and older. There are differences of gender and of race. There are differences of intellect and education. There's differences of spirituality and personality type. But if we share the Christian truth, we have then a solid basis that is outside of ourselves, that is objective, that does not alter. And then the Church of Jesus Christ can anchor solidly to it, whether in Africa or China or the United States, whether in the 20th century, the 2nd century, the 15th or the 1st, the truth. It is essential that the truth of Jesus Christ be understood. When a person comes to join this particular fellowship, one of the things that we do that I think is right on is we ask that person and interact together on the topic of whether or not he or she believes this truth. It is not so much a matter of identifying with the idiosyncrasies of Wooddale Church, but it is a matter of saying, yes, I affirm as the truth, the historic Orthodox Christian faith, that which is rooted in the Bible and that which has been taught through the years by Christians in every culture and place. And if a person does not affirm that, then we have no basis of fellowship. The truth is essential. And when we sometimes hear people say, oh, it doesn't matter what you believe and everyone has their own God and there are all these different interpretations, we come to a measure of nonsense, for the truth is essential. But the truth alone is not enough. There must also be love. And I believe that that truth leads to love, and together they are the stuff of which Christian community is made. Now, there are some tragic examples of one without the other. There are some who get so bent on having the truth that they become doctrinaire and dogmatic and unloving. And that's a sad thing to see. And there are others who become so bent on their understanding of love that they become, in their own thinking, so compassionate that they are willing to compromise the truth of Jesus Christ. I like the way Anglican John Stott says it, that our love grows soft if it is not strengthened by the truth, and our truth grows hard if it is not softened by love. Some of you are familiar with the workings of two-cycle internal combustion engines, the type of engine that we have on a lawnmower, most of them, or many of them, or an outboard engine on a boat or some motorcycles. You know that when you put the fuel in, there has to be a mixture of both gasoline and of oil. You have to have both. Now, the gasoline will give you the fire to get you where you need to go. And the lubricant will come from the oil. But if you put in just the gas, you're going to blow up. And if you put in just the oil, you're never going to get started. But you put in the balanced combination of the two, and you can go exactly where you need to go. And so it is in the Christian community. In fact, it is the basis of the Christian community, that the oil and the gas, the basics, are truth and love. It is the truth of God that gives to us the power, the explosive power of God. And it is the love that we share and demonstrate sometimes under the worst of circumstances that gives the lubricant so that we don't blow up. But when the balance is together, we can go to where God wants us to go. Now, there are those who experience all this in Christian community. And with that experience comes wonderfully, wonderfully, lots of benefits. That's what verse 3 is talking about, the benefits of our being in Christian community. Grace, mercy, peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son. That's what we'll experience, what will be with us in this truth and this love. Grace, you probably know, means a gift. Something is handed over. It's free. So God the Father and Son are gracious. They give to us forgiveness of sin and life eternal, something that we do not earn or deserve. It's as free as any gift can be. And it's so good that sometimes people wonder if it can be true. I've sat with a lot of people to whom I have explained the grace of God, and they say, well, it all sounds wonderful, but it's too easy. It's too good to be true. And they reject it on that basis because they figure you have to work hard for everything that you can get in life that's worth having. Several weeks ago, we had here in our service, I think it was this earlier service that he attended, a West Coast professor who was operating on a research grant, and Wooddale Church became one of the main subjects of research for a book that he's writing. Interestingly, this man once was a member of this church, left here about 10 years ago, would be known to some of you. And he was here for a week studying us and one other church here in the metropolitan area. And he had already done a doctoral thesis that related to the topic of his book, but the focus of research was on the life and the ministry of Wooddale as an evidence or an example of the thesis of his book. He and I went out to lunch together. During that time, he told me something that, first of all, thrilled my heart, but second of all, well illustrated what's here in 2 John 3. He came to Wooddale Church as an adult, married and with children, and he explained to me, as I then recalled, that he had grown up in the context of the Christian community for much of his life. He had been in a Christian home, and that he had even, in fact, gone to Bible college and graduated from there. And then he said to me, but you know, I never really experienced the grace of God until I came to Wooddale Church. Now, I know that part of that is the truth that he heard taught here. But I also know that much of that is the love and the grace that he experienced from you and you and you and you. And he told me about being in people's homes and gifts that were given and teaching that took place and interaction and love. And he said it was here that I experienced the grace of God. That's what Christian community does. It takes a theological concept that's true, no doubt about it, and makes it an experience. Because when we freely receive the goodness of other Christians, even when we don't deserve it, when we cannot earn it, then we begin to taste in small part what the grace of God is all about. Grace and mercy. Mercy is help. It is particularly help for those who are helpless, who cannot do it for themselves. It's pity, in a sense. It's pity for those who are pathetic. It's goods of some sort for those who are needy. We're told, of course, again and again that God is merciful, that when we are at our worst, he is at his best, and when we are helpless, that he helps us, and when we are pathetic, he has pity on us, and when we are weak, that is when his strength is given to us. But again, lots of people say the mercy of God is simply a word in the Bible until it is experienced. And the experience of it comes from Christian community. Christian community is the place where we can be the real us, where we can get to be with people over a period of years, when we can take off the masks that we so often wear in so many other times and places, and when we can receive the kindness, the goodness, sometimes the pity of other Christians who flow with all that God is toward us. You know, I got to tell you, it's true. I mean, it's not just a concept that some old man wrote a long time ago. It's true and it works because I've seen it. I've seen it again and again. I think maybe most impressively was when I first became an assistant pastor and I was in a church that I didn't know very well at that time. And there was a young man who had recently gone through a divorce. He was in his mid-20s, his life was a wreck in terms of job, in terms of the marriage that had ended, in terms of lots of things. And it was then that he came to faith in Jesus Christ, and about the same time that he went on trial in Boulder County, Colorado, for attempted rape. And I watched, more I think as an observer than a participant, I went to his trial, I watched the people in the church relate to him. And I saw an extraordinary thing. I saw something that, again, I'm hard put to describe. I saw an incredible balance of people who in no way condoned what he had done that was wrong, in no way said that that sin was appropriate or made excuses for him, but at the same time demonstrated mercy. Mercy in that they helped him, mercy in that they stood by him, mercy in that they lived out the love of God to him when everybody else was pretty much abandoning him and said that they didn't know him and want anything more to do with him. Grace and mercy and peace.
That's what we get in the benefit of the Christian community together, peace. Peace is when we have a harmonious relationship together. It's when hostilities are over, but it is more than the absence of hostility. We might compare it to the enemies of the United States in World War II, how we fought against Germany, we fought against Japan, and now we have peace, but it's more than a truce, more than an armistice. Today, Germany and Japan are among our strongest of allies. It is those with whom we stand now together. And so when we have peace with God, it isn't just that we called off the war, it's that we're on his side, we're allies together. And when we have peace in the context of Christian community, it is also more than an absence of conflict. It is that we stand on the same side of the line with God and with one another. So important is it to Wooddale Church that we have registered with the state of Minnesota that the purpose of this church is to honor God by bringing lives into harmony with him and one another. That's the purpose of this church. In a sense, it is the purpose of every church. For there is no place better to see the peace of God in actual practice than in the relationships of peace. No longer enemies, but allies. Now, if I'm sensitive, I will hear the thoughts of some who say, all right, I've heard the texts and I've listened to the sermon. Now, let me tell you, it's not always that way. There are those who are thinking, Pastor, I can tell you about a church I know where the truth is corrupted and where love is absent and where grace and mercy and peace are only words that are hypocritically spoken by people who claim to be Christians and really know nothing about living it out. And sad to say, that is sometimes the case. But let me compare. Let me compare to an article that is in the front page of today's Minneapolis Star and Tribune about Eurasian milfoil and what it has done to Lake Minnetonka and how it has infested 25 lakes in the state of Minnesota. Now it's a front page issue and a major hazard to the recreation industry. But you know, we have over 15,000 lakes in this state. And so let us not focus on the 25 that are infested as if they were alone. And let us remember that the reason that we know that we have problems with Minnetonka and with the other 24 lakes is simply because we have almost 15,000 other lakes that are healthy and that are strong. And so it is when we talk about the community of faith, the Church of Jesus Christ. Yes, there are examples. Examples of places and times and people, I suppose you can name them if you chose, that do not live up to truth and love and grace and mercy and peace. But that does not mean they are the norm, for there are millions of Christians now, and there have been millions of Christians throughout history who truly live out what is here talked about. John wrote about it, and we can experience it. But more than that, may we be counted among those as here described, as if these words of 2 John were written not only to us, but about us. To us, the chosen lady, to us, the children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and in love. Let's stand and pray together. To thee, the same God here addressed, we lift our prayers. In the name of Jesus Christ, your Son, we pray that we may be exactly your kind of people, that we may be, without exception, people of truth, unwavering, people of love, just like you love us. And may we experience in the gift to one another and in the receiving from one another of your grace and your mercy and your peace for your glory and for our benefit. In Jesus' name.